It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Snowbird season is wrapping up in Wisconsin. Some residents who flock to warmer locales instead of braving the bitter cold may start returning northward soon. Come on, you can do it.
Madison author Christina Clancy's new novel is set in this season. The main characters, Kim and Grant, are at a crossroads in their 50s. For decades, they've managed a medium-distance relationship in separate Wisconsin communities. Now Grant's small college, where he taught philosophy, is closed, and their twin girls are grown and moved out.
The couple is trying to navigate the confusing transitions of midlife. Christina Clancy joins us now to talk about her third novel, The Snowbirds. Christina, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm a listener.
The main characters, we see their first glimpses of them in the Mojave Desert. Their Prius dies in the desert. And Kim says Palm Springs is what rural Wisconsin would look like after the apocalypse. Why did you choose Palm Springs to plant a pair of Wisconsinites in winter?
Well, my husband and I started spending a lot of time in Palm Springs, especially during COVID. We rented a place for several months there, and I was really surprised at how culturally different Palm Springs was from Madison and how it brought out different sides of my personality. Just being warm for a long period of time and being warm at a time when I'm used to being cold made me feel like I had discovered something new. I felt like I was in a whole different world. So I wanted to write a book that would bring characters from Madison to a place like Palm Springs and just see what happened.
And their destination is this quirky, colorful condo community where, like, everyone just knows each other and their business. you know, we meet this parade of locals who really take this couple in, Kim and Grant. Who is, like, a favorite character or scene to write about there?
Oh, Kim was married to a man named Basil before she met her partner, Grant. And Basil's mother, her former mother-in-law, used to really intimidate her. Her name is Melody Underwood, and she's very wealthy and very sophisticated. And she lives in this rarefied place called Smoke Tree Ranch, which is where Walt Disney used to live. And it's a big ranch right in the south part of Palm Springs that was founded by people who mostly were from the Midwest, actually, and they were worried about their children being kidnapped because Charles Lindbergh's child had just been kidnapped, and it was all over the news. So it's very private to this day, and fortunately, I was able to explore the ranch, and I loved being able to have access to a place that represents kind of old Palm Springs, and it also allowed me to touch on some of the history of the area. I'm not by any means an expert on all of Palm Springs. I experience Palm Springs much the way that Kim and Grant do, but it's nice to be able to dip into some of the history and not just the Rat Pack history that so many people are familiar with when they learn about Palm Springs.
Looking more closely here at Grant and Kim, they aren't married, but they're very committed, of course, to each other. As you write, they have these twin daughters who are grown, who've moved on. How has their relationship changed over time?
You know, I think that they have dealt with a series of crises, and Grant doesn't deal so well with what happens when he's upset. So he's gone on some emotional walkabouts when he and Kim have been dealing with relationship problems. And it hasn't happened very often, just a few times, but it's made her nervous about trusting that Grant is going to be there when she needs him the most. And maybe he has changed and she just hasn't noticed that so much in her relationship. She's so used to being independent. And when Grant goes on a hike and he doesn't come back and she's forced to really examine their relationship, she has a lot to learn about what her relationship really has been, what it could be, and what it is.
I think we might all have a little Kim in us. She has relationship issues. She's got the grown children who don't really need her. And she did so much of the raising of the kids because Grant was off teaching at this small, now shuttered liberal arts college in another place. Can you talk about for the character Kim to be herself and to take up space, which she suddenly can do in Palm Springs?
Yeah, I really wanted Kim to be a character who is really relatable to a lot of readers. I didn't want her to be too quirky or too extreme one way or the other because I wanted to throw her into Palm Springs and just see what would happen to her personality. When she lives in Madison, she likes to go out and she likes to have fun. And Grant doesn't necessarily like to go with her. Like she goes to the Crystal Corner Bar with her friend Octavia, and he'll stay at home. And in Palm Springs, they have all sorts of different opportunities to enjoy social life together. It's really fun to write somebody who just explores all these different parts of her personality. And I think that happened for me when I was in Palm Springs, too. I'm definitely not Kim. Kim is a fictional character, but I know what it's like to be somewhere new and to think about, do places change us? And I think they do.
We're talking with Christina Clancy. Her newest novel is called The Snowbirds. Christina, let's talk about Grant going on a hike, not coming back. But that's not a spoiler, hopefully. I don't know. Grant goes on this hike, doesn't come back. Can you tell us about this theme of getting lost and what comes up with that?
Oh, sure. I mean, first of all, getting lost is a metaphor for so many things, right? Like when you are lost in your life, you're not quite sure where to go next. And I'd say that these characters definitely are lost in life right now, as they face late middle age and their future is looming in front of them. They're kind of lost to each other. They haven't really connected that much in their relationship the way that they should. And then to get lost physically in space is the most disconcerting feeling. And I wanted to explore it because I'm a hiker myself. And when I would go on hikes in Palm Springs, there often weren't other people on the trails. And I would go by myself when I'd go hiking. And just every now and then you'd get lost in your thoughts and you'd look up and I'd not know where I was. And it's such a startling feeling. So I thought a lot about that. And then I met there are two people in our condo complex in Palm Springs, Gord and Roger. They're really good friends. And they told me a story about how a few years ago they went on a hike together and only Gord came back to the condo. And Roger had slipped down an ice chute and Gord was going to call for help. But then Roger started thinking that he could find his way back on his own. And he ended up getting lost for 3 days, which is about as long as you can be lost before people start thinking that they're going from a rescue to a recovery. As much as I wanted to know about what happened to Roger when he was missing, what I was more interested in was what his wife and the people in the condo community had told me about what it was like waiting for news of his survival. And I just couldn't imagine how terrifying it would be to think that someone you love could walk out into the mountains one morning and never come back ever. And how would you move forward in life knowing they could be out there somewhere, anywhere, or maybe they're not there?
I was struck by the amount of volunteers and these responders who rescue people who get lost in the desert. Did you interview emergency personnel to help prepare for this aspect of the book?
I did. I talked to a lot of the members of the Palm Springs Mounted Police. They're a volunteer organization, and they really do everything possible to make sure that people are recovered from the mountains when they go on a hike. And one of the things that I think is really amazing is, people go missing in life every day in different circumstances. But when people go missing on a hike, to know that there are that many people who are willing to put their own safety at risk and go out in the mountains and look for someone is really life-affirming. To think that like every life matters when someone's out there, that they'll do as much as they can to try to rescue someone.
Yeah, and there's this the head of the search party, I think it's Hobie, who says, "Fear can kill you before anything else does." What is the process like to be able to get close to this fear and figure out how it might affect your character?
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised to learn about what happens when people do go missing and they're gone and there's a moment like you might think you're missing and then there's a moment of realization when you know you're like really truly lost and you can just melt down and be blinded by panic. You can forget your own name. You don't make good decisions when you're in a situation like that. And it's a fear that's so primal. And we almost forget how important navigation is now that GPS is available to us all the time. So I loved researching the overwhelming fear that people have when they get lost, and how, like, you're, there's a line in the book about how your eyes narrow to a pinprick when you're in that situation. One of the rescue workers told me about that, and you know, you can't breathe, like everything physiological changes because you just need to survive, but your body doesn't necessarily help you in a moment like that. And you can't rely on your brain to get you to the right place.
I wonder if you could read for us a passage, and this is about Kim and Grant's car. It's the Prius, and you know, this is them and their first glimpse of Palm Springs, and we're pulling up behind it. Can you take us there in what we're seeing?
Oh, sure, absolutely. This might be familiar to Madison listeners, this scene. Now, the bumper was plastered with the names of every liberal presidential, judicial, and senatorial candidate from the past decade, stacked one on top of the other like annual vehicle registration tags. We had stickers that said Recall Scott Walker, Coexist, a magnet from my yoga studio, the local theater, Go Green, and every organization I'd ever worked at. Grant contributed the Darwin fish feet, and he'd made sure that the College of the Mounds decal strategically overlapped the Vanderbilt logo. The Prius was part of our family, a visual history of our personalities, causes, and the dents and scrapes from when the girls learned how to drive. Because it had been Grant's trusty commuter car, it had some cracks in the windshield and a ton of miles.
and before deserting the car, I think Grant is trying to peel off or salvage some of the bumper stickers.
Yeah. I love that Grant does that.
How do you write about a community authentically without, like, crossing a line of typecasting a community? And in this situation, it's Madison.
Yeah, I think that that's a really interesting question, because I thought about that a lot when I was working on the book. And I think what's really helpful is to just try to stay true to your characters and think about how your characters experience a place and what's their truth and what the city or the place means to them. So much of my writing, my other two novels also take place in Wisconsin. And I think that just knowing how they experience the small town of East Troy or like Geneva, Wisconsin, helped me figure out who they were. And like, for example, in my first book, The Second Home, the characters are from the east side of Milwaukee, but I originally wrote them as if they were from Evanston. And the minute I decided that they lived on the east side, I just knew who they were. I knew what that place was like to them, and they came to life for me. And the same thing happened with Kim and Grant. The minute I put them in Madison, they just seemed real to me, and they felt like people that I would know who live here. And I wanted to write about their experience and Madison respectfully, because I truly love Madison, and I would never want people to think that they're typecast, but I don't think it's too unusual to think of people from Madison having the same bumper stickers on their Prius, or even that they would drive a Prius. I think they're pretty common here.
Back to Palm Springs for just a curiosity here. The sound bath. I'd never heard of a sound bath. And I'm wondering, did you take a sound bath in Palm Springs in order to write about one?
It's so funny you asked that question, because I was hearing all about sound baths when I was in Palm Springs, and I kept thinking, this is so California. And I wondered why we don't have sound baths in Madison. And I've been waiting anxiously for a sound bath to open up, because I think that this could be a great business in Madison or anywhere in Wisconsin. But a sound bath is you can do it in a small place, but there's a place outside of Joshua Tree National Park called the Integratron. It's really an unusual structure. It was built by this kind of eccentric guy who thought that he would be able to communicate with aliens from Venus by being in this structure. And Howard Hughes actually even helped make sure that the wood was shipped here from the Pacific Northwest, the redwood. So the whole place was built like a dome, and it doesn't have any nails. So it's acoustically perfect. And now the family that owns the Integratron allows you to come in for 30 minutes at a time, and you have these sound baths where they play these crystal bowls with mallets, and it's pretty amazing. I went thinking that it would be kind of a soft, gentle spa-like experience, but the sound is so intense. It feels like it's cutting you in half. It's such an amazing experience, and it's amazing that you can even fall asleep when you're in a situation like that, but most people do fall asleep, and when you wake up, you feel like every cell in your body has just been jiggled by sound.
As a reader, I thought it was really ambitious for you, and I would imagine it was pretty hard to find the words to write about a sound bath.
It was hard to write about, but I always like those writing challenges where you try to bring someone into a space and a scene. I also played the cello, and in my second book, Shoulder Season, my character was a organist, and so I loved writing about music in that book, and I wanted to be able to write about sound in this one as well.
Christina, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That is Christina Clancy. She is a Madison-based novelist. Her new one, it's called The Snowbirds.
We meet a Milwaukee filmmaker here on the show on Wednesday who has a new documentary that's like a love letter to wild wetlands near Madison. The film is called Wabisa Wetlands. Here's a moment for that conversation.
Over months, the wetland started to open itself up to me, and that's when you really started to see the beauty that makes this place special.
And we want to hear from you about a special natural area in Wisconsin that is sacred to you or holds a special place in your life.
Tell us about that place. Maybe it's in your own backyard or hundreds of miles away. We'd love to share your story in a future program. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
And thanks so much for being part of Wisconsin Today.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.